your manger dogs. Swab the decks and hoist the sails. The guns on board be needing some proper manning. Pieces of eight and a fine wench on your arm, if your work be not too shoddy. Careful not to flounder too badly, though, or you may have to dance the hempen jig as we see you to Davy Jones. And Jeffy, my boy, on with the show.
Well, shiver me timbers. To our listeners from across all regions of the planet, welcome once again aboard the Robin Hood, flagship to the world's one and only cooperatively inspired charity podcast network. Live streaming today from under sporadically sprayed South Korean skies, you've tuned in to episode 46 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I'm your host and Chief Communications Officer, Jaffe Ryder. Hoist in our sails yet once again. Today's guest is South Australian musical veteran Lord Stompy. Known for his insightful songwriting and kick-ass gypsy harmonica style, he's led a rather unique life, raised throughout his teens in a New Age UFO cult led by a crackpot Scottish genius who went on to work for the U.S. government as an advisor on multidimensional phenomenon. In his 20s, he played bass and sang in rock bands, while in his 30s, mostly playing solo shows, dressing in drag, and making hundreds of liters of moonshine. Once trying his homemade absinthe, a top gourmet restaurant reviewer declared, "Out of the 100 brands of absinthe I have sampled, this is in the top 3. Interestingly, he has also been targeted more than once by Australia's Secret Services after being named in federal parliament as a, quote, potential danger, end quote, for writing a satirical punk song poking fun at then Prime Minister John Howard. Most recently, Stompy was awarded honorary title Pirate of the Weld Valley by the Wilderness Society for his piratical role in defending Tasmania's rainforests. He currently plays harmonica and sings in the band Operation Fire Hat, teaches music and busks almost daily. Along with the music channel under his own name, he also maintains Lord Stompy Speaks, another YouTube channel dedicated mostly to highlighting cutting-edge, non-politically correct social and political issues. Over the last year or so, he has resolved himself to the life of becoming a slightly grumpy, middle-aged MGTOW man. Well, here we are once again down on the docks of Skullport Harbor. All I can see, though, are a few pretty dodgy types wandering around. Some I'm familiar with, others not quite as much. Don't know what to make of it, although I do notice Pirate Larry is not here. Is that James West? Do I see James West? Yeah, I think that might be, in fact. James, are you there?
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, great. It's great to have you. I just looked up into the crow's nest there, and yeah, saw you waving down. So it's great to have you up there. I guess you spoke to Pirate Larry and work something out where you'd be kind of you'd be man in the post up from on high for this episode. Is that right?
Yeah. He gets a little downtime, and we passed off a bottle of rum, and I take the post up here at top, and everything's good to go.
Well, you can't go wrong with something like that, I guess, can you? So, yeah. Anything else new from your end of things? I know there's been some developments. You've been doing some more work with Seth, of course, via Contru. And
there's always some more developments going on with Contru. We've like always amassed some kind of project or some kind of investigation that we got going on. So if you haven't been over there yet, Contru.com, definitely go check it out because we got some good stuff coming your way.
And mostly the theme of the content over there, as far as I can recall, it largely has to do with MGTOW, which, for people who don't know, stands for Men Going Their Own Way, as well as a lot of just anti-Zionist stories talking about making the case for why, you know, the state of Israel has been a mistake really from the get-go. So I'm not sure.
As Seth was MGTOW anti-Zionism, and I was just straight up anti-war, anti-corruption, anti-tyranny. And as it goes, all that stuff tends to go together and mashes all together. So everything definitely worked out.
You've even got your own, you've got a couple of YouTube channels, which some people, some of our regular listeners, as well as just the wider audience will know about, including Tyranny Unmasked and East Texas UFOs. Do you just want to quickly, for those who don't know what those two channels are all about, give them a quick rundown of things?
Well, the first one, Tyranny Unmasked, is going to be my, again, anti-tyranny, anti-Zionism, anti-war, or anti-corruption periods, if that's police state or in the whole nine yards. But the second one is going to be strictly UFO related, because that's how I got in the business, folks. That's my baggage. So everything's going to be UFO related and related to my experiences in the paranormal, per se.
I think, in fact, we did a feature show dealing with that whole business just not so long ago. So have that there in the archives if people are interested in checking that out. But in the meantime, we do have a few more just brief announcements before we bring Lord Stompy, our today's feature guest, on board. What we'd like to talk about, really, besides the fact that Pirate Larry, I guess, is off in, I think he had to make a trip to the States, and I'm not sure if it was related to his mother's current situation or just the, you know, taking care of other miscellaneous affairs, but he might even, if time allows, he'll actually be able to make it back before the end of the show. So don't be surprised if he does pop up maybe some at some point before we call it a night here. One of the things that people were asking about, though, is they seem to be a little confused as to when we actually run our show, and as far as that goes, it's the same time every week, 8 o'clock Pacific Standard Time in L.A., Seattle, Vancouver, and Baja. That's out there in the Western time zone, North America. On the East Coast, of course, that's 3 hours ahead by my calculations. James, you'll have to help me out if I'm totally off the mark.
11 o'clock.
New York, Chicago, Florida. You name it. So yeah, there you go. You, of course, you're out in Virginia. I guess that is the Eastern time zone. So it is about 11 o'clock right now where you live. Is that the case?
Yeah. In Del Mar, which is right in between Northeast Virginia, Delaware, and Maryland. It's all the congregation right there.
We're also going to be having an Operation Secret Santa recap overview coming up here shortly. We'd like to kind of produce a show that just strictly focuses on that, a revisitation to the 10-day extravaganza that we managed to put together just a couple weeks ago there, the World Christmas Charity effort that, while we exceeded our expectations, we managed to achieve what we hoped to, simply in the fact that we built upon it last year's successes and took things even a step further. So that was really great. On top of that, we've got a 50th episode coming up here in, should be about a month or so, and we're going to use that to mark our first year anniversary of Pirate Radio Podcasts. We'll be holding open lines and taking calls from listeners, as well as making an effort to invite back former guests, if they be so inclined, to pay us a bit of a visit and share some of their thoughts on the initial experience of being on the show, as well as just where things stand with them in their life at the present moment. So, but outside of that, I'm not sure if there's anything else. Oh, I know. There's one quick thing, another issue too, that was drawn to our attention recently. PayPal. We do have PayPal, And we've rarely talked about it. Unfortunately, we should remind ourselves and remember to talk about it more, just so people, if they are, if they're interested and, you know, so inclined, that they can drop by our Podomatic archive, site, which they can easily find a link to in the show notes. It's, Space Pirate Radio is the name that it goes under. And with, once again, all of our, the shows that we've archived there over the last approximate year or so. And just click on the PayPal button there. We've also got a Patreon, which is yet to be activated, that account. So looking forward to getting that online and seeing, how many people exactly are interested in making donations. Don't forget, folks, half of everything that you do donate, we are, targeting to go back basically to the grassroots and help people out, in need, those who find themselves in less fortunate case than ourselves. So on that note, James, anything further you'd just like to add that maybe we're missing out on here with setting things up with the introduction?
Nope, just brace yourself for whatever this new U.S. establishment is going to take us.
I was just glad to see that things went off without, you know, too much of a hitch.
Without any suicides or assassinations.
Yeah, all the fear porn and that, you know, people like Alex Jones were peddling and so forth. But then again, you know, like but how accurate these claims are, who knows? The way I think one of the...
Well, even... I made note that even Vladimir Putin had pointed out that there were some things heading Trump's way. So
yeah, well, still all you can hope is that he's got the security there in place, that you know, he's with all, any unfortunate incidents can be avoided, of course, at all costs. So. But, yeah, it'll be interesting to see the way things proceed here over the course of the next few years with him and his administration. So, yeah, fasten your seatbelts, folks. In the meantime, I think it's time that we turn our focus and sights to the man of the hour, our guest, Lord Stompy, who is a new member of Minds.com. That's how we managed to cross paths, actually. And I think he's actually hoping, he's almost, Captain Long John Sinclair has been looking upon him quite favorably, actually, with his background, his ancestral roots, and just his whole kind of spunk and demeanor. So, hey, Stompy, you're there? You ready to head on board the Robin Hood?
Aye, aye, Captain. Ready to roll.
I don't know what it is. People often, they refer to me as the captain, but no, that would that would be Captain Sinclair, who's just, you know, typically lurking in the background listening to the show, usually half-corked, or, you know, he's into the hooch, and the hooch is, along with many other things. So he just likes to relax unless there's some sort of a heated engagement or pitched battle that we happen to find ourselves a part of. Great that you could make it. We've had you on a few of our Rogues Gallery segments, so it's super that we finally managed to have this chance to actually put something together on a more formal level. Place where we're thinking of starting here today was, as people could see there from the introduction, you've got a bit of a flair for music. So if we could just maybe go over that a little bit, your music history. It's quite colorful, of course. So I'm not sure how many CDs or musical projects you've been a part of or produced. I know there's been quite a few live performances and so forth. Recently had one of your songs accepted to be part of a movie soundtrack. Is that not the case?
I certainly have. The power of the internet, I merely loaded it, this song up onto the internet, and within about a month I got contacted by a movie maker who really liked the song. He's actually made it the central theme song for the movie. So that was really nice, Captain Jaffe.
Captain, it's Chief Communications Officer.
But when the
CCO.
When the captain's away, there has to always be a captain of the ship, you see? So when Captain Larry's back on board, then you go back and take your rightful place, sir.
Captain, actually, Larry. Larry's the first mate. That's how Long John Sinclair is. That's basically the status he's awarded him with. And no, the captain's on the ship. He's probably listening to the show right now. As a matter of fact, he might be joining us later. So we'll just have to wait and see if that actually happens. You know,
I better behave myself. I don't want to be forced to walk the plank, sir.
Have you read the ship's articles? That's one of the key questions here. That's really important for anyone coming on board the Robin Hood or any other ship, as far as that goes, that, you know, they've got to read those ship's articles, because if they're found to be out of bounds with their behavior or with it, they're presenting themselves, there's all kinds of ways of they can find themselves marooned, or swimming with the fishes, or just dropped off of the. If the pirates are feeling a little bit, you know, in a relatively generous mood, just drop them off at the nearest port of call. So you'll have to check those out when you get a chance. But at the moment, as guests, we tend to try to do everything we can to accommodate people that join us here aboard the ship. So, but the one thing that we do require. Maybe, and James, do you know a little bit about this, how that works with the guests that we have on board, the one thing that we ask of them before they actually manage to make their way on board the Robin Hood?
Yep, I'm sharpening my blade as we speak.
We ask them that they share with us a little pirate story of some kind. You can see it's great that he's got his blade sharp. We all need sharp blades, yes, for sure, and loaded revolvers and muskets and what have you. So,
okay. Well, sure, I've got a little pirate story for you all. I'm actually officially already a pirate. 10 years ago, when I was on tour down on Tasmania, that little island down south of Australia where the Tasmanian devil from Looney Tunes comes from.
Yeah.
Okay, there was... They've been absolutely logging the hell out of the last remaining temperate rainforests down there. These rainforests have been there for 60 million years. And as a last-ditch defence, the locals who weren't redneck loggers, they went down the logging track and they got a bulldozer and they dug a massive hole in the road to stop all the logging trucks. And then this fellow called Dan, he's a great character, he owns a pub down there, he dismantled his aging apple shed that was on his farm, and everybody took the apple shed in parts down to the logging road, and they built a giant, almost life-size pirate ship across the logging road. It was about 60 feet long, about 15 feet wide, and that was there for a year and a half as the pirate ship of the World Valley. So while I was on tour, I went down and met all the crew. We got along great. I ended up, they set up some winches into some of these old-growth trees down there. There were some of the tallest trees in the southern hemisphere. So I ended up going into this tree sit platform about 50 or 60 meters above the ground, and getting to see this beautiful panoramic view of rainforest as far as the eye could see. I was booked in to play a show on the pirate ship, and unfortunately... the Empire came and struck the pirate ship and bulldozed it, confiscated everything from the camp, gave everyone a bit of a roughing up, and arrested quite a few people, as the Empire
nailed
to do.
Nailed broadside by the Kraken. And,
aye, sir.
Yeah, wow, you got to watch out for that for sure. So, well, you know, it's interesting because I'm sure there's a lot of that probably – garnered a fair deal of media attention, so we'll have to go back into the archives. What year did you say this was exactly in Tasmania?
Oh, that would have been back in 2006, I believe, or 2005. There's a couple of photos of it left on the internet. A lot of the articles have actually faded from time. you know, the internet's not there forever. Articles.
Well, I bet you I'll dig around there because that sounds like a great story.
Pirate ship of the World Valley. It was truly a bunch of rat bags. I would just like to say at this point that the hippie activists that you have down in southern Tasmania are the closest thing here in Australia we have to genuine rednecks. They're rough, they're tumble, they're like wild colonial boys from 1880. That was a really different culture to the rest of Australia. Is becoming modernized. We're becoming cosmopolitan. We're losing those older traditional roots to our culture. But down in Tasmania, because it's an island and it's very small, not much goes on. So they don't see much point in changing. It probably would be like some parts of Tennessee or Arkansas or those kind of places.
Becoming a lot more pussified. That's one of the words that I might use. I'm not sure how accurate that would be, but generally speaking, throughout Australia, perhaps, you know, but which kind of leads into this whole thing of you're becoming more interested in the whole MGTOW movement and so forth, which we're going to talk about today. I don't know if we're going to talk about that right now or not. That wasn't the plan, but we can maybe just set that aside if that's all right and kind of get it. But you had a comment? You were going to say something?
Yeah, well, I was being somewhat of a slightly alpha kind of person. I was kind of forced into being MGTOW. The situation with especially all the younger generation are becoming a lot more metrosexual. The term we've been using a lot lately is cucklords.
Well, here's one for you. I came up with just the other day, Stompy. How about this one? Cock shaming.
Oh, definitely.
Do we got to trademark that one, or where did that come? Like, you know, it's like I asked some people. It's like, never heard of that one before. Run with it. That's you talk about. Like, yeah, you know, get the you know cock shaming. You know, definitely, yeah.
Now, interestingly, the town I live in is called Adelaide. We're not that big. We're not that small. We're about 1 million people. And you know how Canada, especially places like Toronto and that, they seem to be this bastion of leftist, metrosexual, divisive identity politics. Out of all of Australia, Adelaide is probably the number one city for the exact same thing. So in the 1970s, we actually had the first, I think it was the world's first openly gay prime minister. This guy was called John Bannon, and he famously in the 1970s wore pink shorts to Parliament one day. So he was out and proud. And interestingly enough, this legacy's never – he was kind of like the Trudeau.
A senior or junior?
The junior, the one that's in Canada now. Now, it's funny because we're also a very traditional city, so things haven't changed that much since then. So we've always seen ourselves as – we're kind of like have this – ossified time warp where we think we're this metrosexual cutting edge thing, but really we've been red on those laurels since the late 70s. And that's interestingly enough was you did ask me to possibly touch on this. Now the big thing that's been going down lately has been Pizzagate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, for those people at home who don't know, just about everyone knows what Pizzagate is, but it's this huge pile of confusing information that seems to be pouring out all over the place from places such as WikiLeaks, various other leaks, is hitting the internet like a wildfire. Now, Pizzagate's basically, to cut a long story short, there's allegations left, right and centre of pedophilia going on in the highest rings of power in Washington, in high levels of business. It doesn't seem
Hollywood,
to be
Hollywood establishment media, not just pedophilia, but of claims apparently of child cannibalism, blood disease ritual, dark occultic quasi satanic. You know, sacrifices, you name it. It's the worst things you could possibly imagine.
Yeah, definitely. And what I want to say here is because of our unique history and the fact we're somewhat isolated from the other cities, it's about nearly a thousand kilometers to the next major city, really, is Pizzagate literally hit our state, our capital city, in the late 80s. And when I was 15 in 1989, I was at a Pogues concert, and some rather rich, well-to-do people sat down and began talking to me. I thought they were quite interesting people. They offered me a very, very tiny spliff to smoke, which I smoked, and before I knew it, I was completely paralyzed. And these people, because the venue was so crowded, there was so much chaos while this live Pogues gig was going on, they basically picked me up and made it look like I was walking with them towards the door, and straight away I knew what was going on. And I was almost blacking out. I was struggling to keep my consciousness. And also rumours of high-level pedophilia had been hitting our media for about a year at that stage. There's various allegations of top senior lawyers. Finally, one of our magistrates, a guy called Justice Liddy, did actually get caught with a really long history of abusing young boys. There seemed to be a lot of collaboration from the police providing him with these victims. So back in 1989, I was aware of this problem, and when these people leading to me to the door, they weren't just middle class. You know, these were Benetton suits. I remember seeing the guy had a Mercedes-Benz keyring. You know, they were ordering the top drinks at the bar. So just before I got out the door, I knew, like, excuse a bit of bad language, Captain, I knew I'd be fucked. If they got me out that door, I'd have been done for.
You'd be buggered.
Yep, mate, I'd be buggered, matey.
More ways than one.
Oh, yeah. And to cut straight to the point, a lot of kids here in Adelaide did actually disappear. A few of them were found murdered after being tortured to death. There was a famous case, Kelvin Kreese, and it actually was the major news presenter's son. This was a guy on mainstream news. His son disappeared, and when they finally found him about 3 weeks later, he'd been starved, he'd been sodomized, he'd been tortured, and he'd finally died. This is terrible. Like, it was a terrible story. He'd been died by being sodomized with a knife. So when it comes to high-level ritual pedophilia, I believe our city was one of the first to have this happen and for it to be publicly start getting exposed on a large scale. The reason it did was these guys got so bold. They were literally cruising the streets. It was getting to the point where all the street people actually were recognising certain cars as being, that's those rich people that grab you and take you in. So just before they got me to the door, I had the tiniest bit of strength left in my body, and I was having this vain effort to push back. And this, of course, made them push me slightly harder through the door. Now, at the door, there's a very large, rough-looking chap, and I knew they'd push me a little bit harder to get me out the door. So I deliberately did something counterintuitive to them, which was, as they pushed me harder, they would have expected me to push back harder. And instead, I went with the momentum of them pushing me, and I deliberately aimed my head for this large guy at the door. And I literally fell forward and headbutted him really hard in the stomach. Winded him. He dropped his beer on the floor. Next thing I knew, I kind of blacked out for a short while. But then there's this very, very angry working class guy wanting to beat the crap. He was literally screaming at me going, like, my God, what did you do that for? I'm going to punch you in the head. Get on your feet. You owe me a beer. And I was thinking, well, I'll prefer to have my head kicked in than the alternative. Then I blacked out again. Then next thing I knew, this working class guy dragged me up, dragging me to my feet. And he dragged me to a corner and sat me on the couch. And he was saying, man, are you all right? Like, has somebody spiked your drink or something? And obviously, while I was blacking out, he realized there's something very wrong with me. So luckily, he didn't beat me up. But as he dragged me back onto my feet, I had a look around the venue. Of course, these very rich people had quickly disappeared. What I'd done was deliberately created a scene that would create a lot of drama so that I'd get a lot of attention from all the people around. So that would, of course, any predator like that, they want to be leaving a venue, not being seen. And so I survived, and then I missed out on the rest of the Pogues concert because I was basically half unconscious on this couch. I only regained full consciousness by the end, and even then I could barely walk. I literally fell down this flight of stairs and staggered my way home. If I could finalise this story, I would just say a week later, a newspaper report came out. A street kid said exactly the same story. He said a Mercedes-Benz in almost exactly the same area where this pub was. He said a Mercedes-Benz turned up. A couple of very rich guys jumped out. There was two rich guys with me. They gave this young guy a joint. He went unconscious. Next thing he knew, he woke up locked in the top story of a mansion in the richest part of town. He literally smashed his window, jumped out of a second-story window, ran to the police, and his story fitted exactly with mine. Yeah, the joint, falling unconscious, two rich guys, a Mercedes-Benz. Surprise, surprise, nothing ever happened. If we can sum up that story, I could say all these years later, about two of them officially got caught. One was a famous case, this guy called Von Einem. He got put in jail for 30 years. And the other guy was Justice Liddy. So that's the Australian Pizzagate that happened. It broke 20 years before Pizzagate now. So
that was I thought it was, wasn't it 90, was it 93, 94, 95, the Pogues concert? What year was that exactly?
They did come out, their first concert in Australia would have been the late 80s. It would have been 89.
So another addendum, or just something to add to that, on a related note, as I recall in one of the after shows that we had done together where you joined us, you'd also mentioned something about a gang leader in one of Australia's better-known bike gangs who had made an attempt to kind of blow the whistle on things as far as that whole racket of child abduction and torture or what have you, just the sadism that's involved to it all. And but he had, I guess, the inside sort of scoop on things from a number of different angles. And he went, I guess, to the media and tried to blow the whistle. And what happened just quite shortly after that?
Well, yeah, that was a very interesting and shocking case. The guy's name escapes me, but he was the head of the Rebels. At the time, this would have been, it was 10 years ago, because very recently an article came out in the paper with his daughter talking about this. So the Rebels were probably about number two or number three after the Hells Angels here in Australia. So he was the head of the whole gang. So he's a really big dude. Now, this had to be a setup by the powers that be, because he hit the front page of the main newspaper. Now, this pedophile gang here in Adelaide was called The Family because it was believed it was run by several leading families in the community. And they, everything we heard, they kind of, there was like up to about 2,000 people involved, 2,000 perpetrators, and they all considered themselves this one big weird family of weirdos, very, very creepy stuff. So the head of the rebel biker gang came out. He was on the front page of the Advertiser saying he'd nearly finished writing a book and that he was going to blow the whistle on, he said he knew all, who all the main players in the family were, and he was going to blow the whistle on the whole thing in his new book. A week later, he walked out of a pub and he just disappeared. His bike was found in the car park of the pub. You know, so this was a major, fairly major thoroughfare. There have been people coming and going. He literally disappeared, and no one has heard a trace of him since. His daughter got in the paper about 2 or 3 months ago saying she's accepted that he's been killed over the matter. He had to have been set up. For him to hit the front page of the newspaper and being shown as saying that, and then to be disappeared so magically and so well, literally that's a warning. That a lot of people in the underworld, these pedophiles got so big that I've talked to some who I call some slightly bigger people in the underworld, and they've got a fair idea of who those players were. That was a message to the underworld. That it wouldn't have just been a message to the average person. Some of those underworld people would have been thinking of trying a little bit of blackmail on these leading people, and that would have been a message to those underworld folks.
No dead man switch, no insurance policy, apparently.
Oh, yeah, his daughter said his whatever he had written for his book, that all disappeared as well. So,
well, that was pretty, that's certainly not the way I don't think that I would go about doing something like that. You'd want to have that in place. You know, you want to have your ass covered, obviously, or inevitably things like that will happen. So that's
well, he was a big man, and he thought he was very well protected by being such a, alpha male for such a notorious biker gang. He thought he was protected, and that was the message. The very action itself was the message. So sadly, we'll never know. And the final thing, it did actually reach a level where so many people in the community here in Adelaide were crying out for justice, that some sort of secretive parliamentary and judicial inquiry was held into these matters on behalf of the public, supposedly. And somehow it all kind of disappeared into something called the Mulligan Report. They didn't talk about it much, but apparently the findings are so top secret that the public's not allowed to know about this report, and it's literally been sealed to any freedom of information findings for the next 80 years, by which time any perpetrators will be long dead and gone.
That's incredible. That's totally unacceptable, of course. That's an outrage, and that cannot be allowed to stand, period.
I know, and it's...
Well, no, and it starts by exposing the people that are supporting it. It's like saying, well, no, we have to, you know... their guilt, there's... What, guilt and complicity? How bizarre. That is just, nah. I don't see how any reasonable person could support something like that at all. It speaks volumes. We got to keep things moving along here. We have a lot of content, issues we want to hit on here with you today, and God only knows.
Too many issues and not enough time, Jeff.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the problem with this modern world.
Yeah.
There's a lot of evil, a lot of bad things going on.
And, we want to kind of lighten things up a little bit here, though. You know,
definitely.
But so that's why now we didn't really get into your music career too much. But if you could just talk a little bit more about the number, just a little bit about your music history, the number of albums and CDs you put out, your performance career, as well as this business with the, you do street busking every day and offer music lessons, mostly for harmonica. I'm not sure what else, but, and ultimately, you know, if you could talk a little bit about this movie soundtrack deal, just kind of tie that all together for us, if you would.
Oh, sure. Well, harmonica is my number one instrument that I'm good at. I'm regarded as one of the best players in Australia. So I am a multi-instrumentalist. I spent my early years in the 90s playing bass and singing in grunge-style bands. You know, Nirvana, and all that stuff was very big. So I was in my early 20s trying to be a rock and roll star, which is the kind of thing that seems great when you're in your early 20s. As a lot of those young people, I was in bands that were very talented, but a lot of those younger people don't really have a head for holding their lives together. You know, there's a lot of drinking, quite often a lot of drugs, and a lot of silly ego. So eventually I went solo. I brushed up my skills as an acoustic guitarist somewhat so that I could play solo, get out of being trapped in other people's problems, so as to speak. Up until about 10 years ago, I was touring around a bit as a solo artist. I put out my album, my album called Individuality, Just Say No. So that was an ironic title.
Is that spelled N-O or K-N-O-W?
No, that's spelled N-O. So I put that out at the time of John Howard. It was a very right-wing prime minister. He came out. He'd been running Australia for a long time, and his main claim to fame was fear-mongering. After the 9/11, he really cracked down with this whole dialogue of, you know, we're all going to be invaded, you know, everyone has to be afraid. And that dialogue, of course, began feeding this government softening up of people's resistance to increasing powers to the Secret Services, increasing powers of public surveillance. It was all for the public good, you see, Jack.
Yeah, sure. Just give up your rights so we can protect them.
And that's it. Interestingly enough, 9/11 happened not long after. There was an incident in Bali where a top Australian tourist destination, it was a hotel. It got blown to smithereens by some Islamic crazy dude. Like, it was one of the hugest, even though it wasn't on Australian soil, literally hundreds of people, Australian people, died. It was a hotel mainly frequented by Australians. So that really played well into the dialogue of fear that the Islamics are now coming to blow up our entire country.
In the midst of all this, what sort of immigration policy was the Howard government embracing? Was it closed doors?
The Howard government ostensibly was quite closed doors. Back then, they were very much more like Bush Jr. He was very, very closely tied to the same policies, the same mindset. Unfortunately, we were very, very heavily involved under John Howard in the Iraq War. Of course, strategically, that was a terrible thing to do. We were very heavily involved, but because we're such a small country, we contribute, you know, even... It was a bad strategic thing from any point of view. It was a bad thing to do humanitarian-wise. We're killing all these people for God knows what, Jaffe. But then, of course, it bred all this backlash against our country overseas. And, you know, you get to the point where you question, are the elites that are running the show actually doing this to deliberately breed a backlash and to keep... so that they can keep us in fear and can keep pushing through these attacks on civil liberties, on civil rights, increase... what they have here, it was called Operation Echelon. I remember it coming out in the early 90s, and Australia was a test case for identifying people's voices, like tapping phones and having a computer program that identified people's voices. So this was before mobiles were in use more popular use. So it meant that no matter whose phone line you used, if the government wanted to, they could actually get an audio trace of your voice and track you down. Australia, John Howard, that's what we're under. And it ended up blowing up on me a bit. On my first album that I put out back then, Individuality, Just Say No, I put out this very... Frank Zappa punk tongue-in-cheek song called Hurry Up and Die, John.
Right. In fact, we've got that queued up here for you, Stompy. And in the meantime, what we'll ask you to do is just get you to mute yourself and then head over to the live chat we have streaming in our YouTube channel. There's a few questions people have there for you. That'll give you a chance to just kind of read comments over and collect your thoughts and think about what it is you'd actually, how you'd like to respond to them when we come back after the tune. But before we do that, let's just quickly head back over to James there up in the crow's nest. I know it's his first time up there. The winds can get pretty blustery and forceful. Got to kind of watch your step. You're not drinking up there, are you, James?
Not too much.
Yeah. How is it there? How do things look from your vantage point?
Everything looks great. The seas look smooth. It's not even choppy at all, honestly. But there's some fog up ahead, so we don't know what lies ahead so far, so keep your eyes open.
Okay, so what we're going to do here then, folks, and thanks for that update, James. Well done. We're gonna queue up Lord Stompy's tune, Hurry Up and Die, John. This is a song that he wrote independently and just released a few numbers of years ago. Let's give it a quick listen, and then we'll resume the show in just a couple minutes. Enjoy.
Australians, oh, let us rejoice. Our future's looking bleak. With golden showers from Johnny Howard, I think we're up shit creek. Johnny, die. Pull out your ivory tower. Die, Johnny, die. Here's to the death of Johnny Howard. Even my grandma says that you're a wanker. You have the charisma of a boiled cauliflower. Run to Daddy Uncle Sam when you get your ass into a jam. Calling all the shots for you. So die, Johnny, die. Fall out your ivory tower. Die, little Johnny, die. Reprehensible moral coward. Your army of economists dictate to us the way it is. We live in a society, not a fucking economy. If you're so rational, why must you pull the wool? To the gullibles, insecurities. And die, little Johnny, die. Fall out your ivory tower. Die, Johnny, die. Your mommy will be so proud of you. Prime Minister of Australia. Short-sighted dwarf at the helm of our ship. Isn't that an iceberg up ahead? Die, Johnny, die. Fall out your ivory tower. Die, little Johnny, die. Here's to the death of Johnny Howard. White liberal racist desires from the humble redneck messiah. Pauline Hanson says you cheat. You stole her bear's policies. Back to 1953 at the one dimensional OC. Hiding in conformity, cause change is a scary thing. Be so proud of you, Prime Minister of Australia. Short-sighted dwarf at the helm of our ship. Let's hope the peasants don't mutiny and throw rocks at your ivory tower.
Hurry Up and Die, John, from Lord Stompy. And I guess that, once again, that came out on independent release that you put together a few years ago, Stompy. I'm not sure what the title of, I think you said it a couple times. I guess I wasn't paying close, focused on other things. You're multitasking. What was the name of the indie release you put out there?
My indie
release? Yeah, that was a part of...
It's called... it's called Individuality, Just Say No.
Just Say No.
So you can download that. I'll just let the people know. If you go to kicktone.com,
mm-hmm.
you'll find it's a music downloading site. So I got that, and I have some other stuff. There's some free stuff of mine you can download as well, but you can download that album for $5.50. Australian, which is absolute bargain.
How many cuts do you have? How many cuts do you have on the release?
13 songs on it, Jaffy. Oh,
all right.
The Hurry Up and Die Johnny song. Now that's really interesting because John Howard was doing all this fear mongering, and I was really trying to aim where it hurt with John Howard. He was quite a vain and mendacious little man. He didn't cope with criticism too well. So I put out that song, and I found out how thin-skinned he was, because then I literally got there was a short discussion about me in National Parliament about how my song, when they use those weasel words that make you look worse than you are.
Yeah, it's and like it, this could potentially lead to it could be like a national security issue or something like that. It's a threat to the, you know, perceived as a threat to the head of state. We need to send people around to talk to this fellow and get some information.
Yeah.
So that's what happened, I guess, is it?
Well, yeah, I didn't know about it, and somebody phoned me up and said, you're going to get in a lot more trouble than you've realized. So I said, what? And they said, well, I've just been phoned by a reporter, and they're about to release this story on you in the paper. I was like, me? I'm just like some idiot musician dude who's making moonshine in his bathroom at this stage of my life. And then the next day in the paper, they actually said they said it in a way that one of his John Howard's ministers, Kevin Andrews is the guy's name, just some other right wing dickhead, came out with this thing saying that I was supporting unions, that I was supporting all these leftist causes, and that I was basically endorsing the assassination of John Howard. And he kind of handpicked a couple of lyrics from there and joined them in together in the way that made it seem the worst message possible. So I literally found myself being followed by the Secret Services for a number of months. I had police always getting on my case. That was just a loud message being sent from above to really let me know what kind of power they had over my life. And, they didn't make it that bad. They could have made it a lot worse. But at the time, it really shocked me to see the extent that the state can actually go to really make an example of you and make you feel like you're suddenly not really as safe as you once thought you were.
Right. Trust the state to protect you. Oh. doesn't always necessarily work out that way. So, myself and a lot of fellow pirates, buccaneers, what have you, freebooters, we take the position as libertarians largely that if we need the government or the state's help, we'll call them. Otherwise, we really don't want anything to do with them whatsoever. So it's really that simple. And yeah, if they are coming around poking their nose in our business, then that's when things definitely do become an issue. And, it's not a good thing necessarily. So, but did you get a chance to, hopefully over the, while we're playing the tune there, look over the comments, just in the YouTube, the streaming live chat, anything you want to just quickly address?
Yeah, there's a little one from Joe, who I've had to chat to, saying most bikers want to kill pedophiles, and I can honestly say that there are some bad bikers out there, but I would go as far as to say that most criminals, no matter how bad, generally do want to kill pedophiles.
Well, unless they're on an airplane headed headed to Jeffrey Epstein's island, wherever it is, via the Lolita Express. I mean, because there you have both criminals and pedophiles kind of all in one, is what it would seem.
You know, now, this
brisk business. So,
just a final reference to the old to the problem we had with the family here in Adelaide was I know you a long-standing criminal chap. He was a one of the number one street fighters in Adelaide for a number of years. Being a musician, I get to meet all sorts of people.
It's sure,
it's just the way it is. Quite often, there's a it's a side of life that the average person doesn't get to see too much of. But with a lot of criminals, there's actually a lot better basic honesty than with a lot of people. It's you know, the law of the street, you're as good as your word. If you go around bullshitting or giving fake information or making too big a deal of yourself on the street, then you're going to find you're going to be in a lot of trouble. So this street fighting guy I know, he told me that it was this Mercedes-Benz. He was 17 years old back in the late 80s, and the Mercedes-Benz picked him up, and it was this very rich lawyer. And this was how brazen these pedophiles here in Adelaide had gotten, was this the guy, just as he's driving the car along, he hadn't waited for 2 or 3 minutes before he grabbed this guy's leg. Now, this guy was a homeless street kid, and he had to fight really hard, and he'd been homeless since he was 13. This is why he was a street warrior. You know, he'd literally fought for his life since the age he was 13. So the moment this guy sort of touched the inside of his thigh, Mr. Street Warrior dude just instinctively turned around and king hit this guy driving the Mercedes in the head.
Sure.
The guy fell unconscious. Driving the car. Suddenly, before he knew it, this Street Warrior guy was trying to steer this car, and ended up they crashed straight first into a very famous statue that's a landmark here in Adelaide.
Ironic is that, huh?
They crashed into this big old statue head first.
Watch out for those fancy dressed lawyers and driving the BMWs. You just never know what kind of
is it? Interesting bit of street justice. He grabbed this guy's wallet and briefcase and ran off out the car as fast as he could and made himself a bit of quick cash.
You know, Stompy, this is great because we have you billed here as a renowned Aussie musician and raconteur, and you're definitely proving that to this point with the number of stories and yarns that you're able to share with us here today. The unfortunate thing is that we're working against the clock here. We've got about technically half an hour. Sometimes we run a little bit over. Time really does fly on the Robin Hood. But just jumping around a little bit now, because we want to get to these other issues too. But your grandfather was in the Navy. Let's just, if we could hear a little bit about that and how he managed to rise so magically through the ranks. it's something that seems to still go on today for some strange reason. How does that all wash out?
Well, I'm very lucky that I grew up having my main influences in my childhood were my grandfather and my grandmother, who were British. And when the Nazis started their shenanigans in World War II, my grandparents were working class British, but they were very patriotic and very, very open-minded people. That I was taught not to be racist. I was taught to treat everybody with fairness and equality because that was my grandparents' stance on life. When the first Jamaican blacks used to turn up in the ghettos, it was in 1930s that Jamaicans began emigrating from Jamaica to England. And the Jamaicans did get a lot of racism when they got to England. But my grandparents were some of the first people to welcome the Jamaicans into the community and, you know, have them over for tea. And so when the Nazis broke out with their racist rhetoric, my granddad did not wait to be signed up by the armed forces. He saw that they were a threat to freedom and democracy all over the world. He marched straight down to the British naval place and signed up on the line to fight the Nazis. I would just like to say this is an aside here, is a lot of people these days with the new form of cultural Marxism say a lot of bad things. Apparently the white race has got a history of all this bad racism, et cetera, and I would like to say that although there have been problems with colonialism and racism, these people aren't seeing the other side of the story, where millions of people, like my granddad, literally volunteered to join the armed forces to fight racism. So they put their own lives on the line. They were brave men and women who saw the Nazis as being anti-democratic and highly racist. So that... he charged off, and he was involved in some of the greatest battles. He was in the Battle of the Mediterranean. He was in the Battle of Crete. And he was a very innocent man when he joined the Navy. Very innocent. And now there's one thing. The Navy is the same as the prisons, as the same. Worldwide, this is the same. What happens when you get a group of men under intense stress in a place like prison or the Navy? If you're on board that ship, you're stuck in a hold most of your life for like up to 3 months on end. So within about 3 months, he told me that literally 60% of the men on the ship had decided that becoming gay was an option. this was the British Navy tradition. It was kept...
And they were straight before this? Are you sure? They weren't gay going into things.
Most of them were straight. The majority were straight. Now, you've got to realize that they're all going a bit crazy because of a war being on as well. Mm-hmm. And there was another factor involved with the British Navy. It was a tradition that was hundreds of years old. You literally got an imperial pint of British Navy rum every day as a coping mechanism during times of war. It was their antidepressant of the war. They had big, giant oak kegs down in the hold. An imperial pint of rum, that's 600 mils of rum. That's literally about, by today's standards, 65%. those guys, it was just insane. And this was a tradition that, so they're all drunk out of their mind.
Sure.
They had...
Yeah, and pirates, of course, historically would they'd mix the high proof rum with water. That's the grog.
That's right.
So they would have to get a cut with something. We also, as I recall, we discussed the whole business of weed. Although historically, I'm sure that going back a few hundred years, you would have found that on quite a few pirate ships, depending on the captain's disposition, his whole take and attitude towards that. Scythian warriors historically. That's what they were all about. The Scythians, they're known for their, horsemanship, and they were fighters as well too. Of course, more land based, I guess. And then the assassins, Hashashin and whatnot. For some people, I guess it gets them pretty fired up and in the mood to kick some ass, as it were. So
it depends on what you mix it with. You know, some people mix it with ephedrine based compounds. Speed, if you look at what modern speed is now, that was available, available, as a Chinese herb. It's called ephedra.
Is that natural? That's a natural Chinese herb, is it?
Yeah. I've actually been able to obtain it a few times in my life. Wow. And you make up a big cup of tea out of it, and it literally has this very stimulating effect. So
like a caffeine, a strong caffeine drink? Almost,
that's where we get the name ephedrine from, they extracted it from the ephedra plant originally.
Yeah. Oh, this is great. I mean, I would love to see like books and, you know, movies is what I'm seeing here in my head as far as the content and discussion material that we're kind of throwing out, you know, kind of back and forth here. But with your grandfather, let's just kind of see if we can kind of wrap that up? Is just a quick couple other little points you want to hit on there before you just kind
of there's a couple of points. I mean, so with the men, the majority of men were what you'd call opportunistic sodomists. It was the only thing they had going for them at the time. Okay, they're like, there's no girls. We've been at sea for 2 months. bend over, Jeffrey. With the higher echelons, the officers and the captains, sodomy is the classic old boys British system where it was much more accepted for the officers and the captains of the ships to be homosexual, except, of course, it was British, so nobody actually talked about it.
Keep a stiff upper lip.
Yeah, stiff upper lip, and as you know, what we all get up to on board the ship stays on board the ship, old chap. All that. So my granddad was he was an opera singer, and for a working class chap, he was quite well cultured. He was more educated than the rest, so all the officers liked him because they said, "Well, Hopkins, old chap, you know, come up to the officers' mess, have some drinks with us, because you're not like all those other awful working class chaps, you know. They're all so common. They're common as well. You're cultured. We like you." It's like, oh, this is great. I'm being shown all this favoritism by the officers. Now, he didn't realize. He was very innocent. He didn't realize they're actually grooming him.
Right.
So they're giving him all these extra benefits and just in his naivety, he thought, oh, this is great. I'm getting all this extra stuff. And one day this officer took him to, well, we're going to shore now, Hopkins. I'll take you out for some dinner and we'll go see a movie together. And they're sitting down in the movie cinema together. And he's like, well, my granddad's still being very formal. And, you know, he's like, well, Officer Jenkins, it's very nice for you to do all these things for me. And this officer slaps his hand on the inside of his thigh and he said, don't call me Officer Jenkins. You can call me Reggie. Suddenly the penny dropped. I was going, oh, right.
Oh, geez. So, and where did things, how did that all play out then in the wake of this rather, well, highly uncomfortable situation, of course.
Well, by that stage, my granddad had been, because of the sodomy of all the other men, he'd been desensitized. It was when that happened, he was like, oh, right, okay, finally the pennies dropped. So he ended up getting some he never crossed to the other side, so he ended up getting some small promotions. If he had a just bent over for the elites, and they would have opened up the golden gates for him and promoted him.
Yeah. Makes a person wonder, too, just how systemic this is, not just in places like the Navy, but also the world of politics, entertainment, I mean, you name it. Hollywood is said to be, for example, quite infested with I'm not sure if that's the best word or not, but it's the best, you know, I could come up with. So yeah, infested with, dominated. You could use that way of selection of language too, I suppose. But a lot of gays and run by people, nice Jewish folk too, of course. Sometimes those two overlap, other times they don't. Yeah, historically very, very homosexual. So, and it ties all back into, it seems, what we're seeing here now with this Pizzagate business, too, with the sexual depravity and perversity, where the heterosexual thing's just not good enough. You gotta, if it feels good, do it. And we can be bi if you want, and we can get in a little bit of that bestiality thing, if that kind of, I mean, with the dog licking your balls or whatever your thing happens to be, you know. So just go for it. But let's just hold it there for now on that whole matter, because we got to keep things moving along. There's a lot of great other material we want to get into. Couple things here, just to remind people, you do have a YouTube channel, of course, too. No homepage that I was able to find, although you did mention the one website where you have the music downloads available, and then the Twitter account, which I did a little recon on yesterday, and that seems to be pretty inactive, and understandably so, because Twitter in many ways really kind of does suck compared to places like mine.
I'm trying to starve Facebook and Twitter of any interactions.
Right. Right. And we do want to talk about Minds before we let you go.
Minds.com,
as well.
People. Make sure you get onto Minds.com. Yeah. Free flow of information and no data mining.
No censorship. Booster That's points. Right. What else they got? There's so much they got going for them. It's open sourced. You know, and that's one of the things we're, in fact, working or toying around with here with WPRPN, of which, you know, Pirate Radio Podcast, a show that we do here on a weekly basis. This is just an offshoot of that, really. We're basically, we've been asked to serve as the flagship for this grander, larger enterprise, the Flotilla project, essentially. There's open sourcing, perhaps, just, you know, the way that people would like to see things unfold and evolve with WPRPN. We recently did put up an FAQ page as well, too. I'm not sure, Stompy, if you saw that yet or not, but just to give people, there's so many questions that come in, of course, so just to give people a clear sense of what we've really envisioned and kind of the direction that we're hoping to take things in here. We don't really have to get into that too much right now. Let's just quickly, though, remind people where they can download your music. And on top of that, we are going to close with one of your songs as well, too, which is, I thought it was like the Drunk Dog Polka or something.
The Stray Dog Polka.
The Stray Dog Polka, yeah, which you recommended as being a pretty decent pirate song. So we...
It's a little bit jiggish. It's a little bit piratey. I do enjoy a good sea shanty. I've written a few sea shanties in my time. I write my sea shanties in generally in honor of my granddad. You know, he got to see the whole world. He educated me about life. You know, with this, especially with this gay and homosexual thing. So with this. Cultural Marxism that's emanating from Hollywood, and it's like you said, that's I'm all for tolerance, I'm all for diversity, but what's happening now is here in Australia, is happening all over the West, is the LGBT initiative has finally really hit our schools hard.
Right.
So this was in the paper the other day that children now are being, from about the age of 11 on, are being schooled in homosexuality. It's now law that a child can be considered any gender. If an 11-year-old child is male and they decide that they're a twin spirit or whatever, you know, that we're aware of this madness, but that legally the teacher has to call them that. They can use any toilet they want. This cultural Marxist program is, of course, being done in the name of fairness, diversity. We have to let the children make their own minds up. Now, everything from the media through the education system now is actually going overkill on flooding our children with just too much over-sexualized information. I mean, if you can imagine, when you were 13 years old, sex starts to get on your mind. It seems like a great thing.
Sure.
I will explain to you. My granddad was the original person for equality and fairness. I remember being 8 and my granddad sitting down and just giving me a very brief explanation. He said, homosexuals, they're either men that like men or women that like women. I said to him, what does that mean? He said, well, you know how some men have their boyfriend and girlfriend. I was like, well, that's weird, isn't it, Granny? He said, yeah. He said, just don't worry about it. Just treat them like a normal person. Just treat them like the same as everybody else and don't worry about it because they're equal to everybody else. Now, that was all I needed to know so that I'd have an egalitarian outlook on life. As an 8-year-old, I just needed a 10-minute talk that, you know, don't think of these people as different. You know, I did not need... Okay, I'll go forward a little bit. When I was 14, I was quite a shy kid still, and I had some, because I wasn't very masculinized, I had some slightly feminine traits. I remember a school counselor sitting me down and literally, like, giving me this really bizarre long talk about have you considered homosexuality and all this. Now, this school counselor, obviously, they thought they were doing the right thing because they saw I was a little bit, shy and effeminate, and they're like, oh, I've got to help him. The longer this talk went on, the more and more insulting and annoying it was to my intelligence. Like, yeah. By the end, I actually remember just saying something, well, look, I really just don't like the idea of cock. I like the idea of vagina. Why are you trying to do this to me? As a kid, I found this was very, very intrusive. They were making all these assumptions that.
Well, yeah, I mean, somebody could be sued over all that, you know, bare minimum. So I hear James West snickering away there in the background, coming through up along the lines through the crow's nest. So James, we wanted to bring you in. Actually, it's good timing because just a quick, don't want to leave you feeling too left out of the picture here. So any thoughts? Just
I was going to say that the Controversial Truth Project just put a Minds channel together as well. So if you haven't joined us over there, be sure to do that on Minds.
Yeah, you guys are everywhere. I've been noticing, been watching. It's like, geez, these guys are getting around. So, and is that Seth behind that largely?
Yeah, Seth's on that one.
Okay, very good. anything else? Just the context to this kind of summarize or recap some of the issues
One more thing about Contru is that we're always looking for volunteers. So if you an article writer, social media junkie, or anyone that's willing to give some kind of effort, we always are looking for more help on board. As far as commenting on anything that's been said here today, no, I've just been enjoying hearing Stompy's story. I haven't actually got to hear it before for the most part.
All right. Okay, Stomp. Well, you know, we've got an after show, too. I'm not sure if Stompy, if you're going to be able to make it to that or not. Yeah, I know you've got a regular busking gig that you like to head out to. There probably will be some people that will have more questions for you in the after show if you want to maybe just stick around for a short while. Yeah. And we'll see where things go from there. But let's move on to a couple things. I saw your depleted uranium video. I think that's what you're talking about, if memory serves, with the and that ties into the whole Clinton Lewinsky scandal. I don't really want to spend a lot of time on that, but nuclear weapons, what a distraction.
Yeah, that was just the last minute swipe at Hillary. You know, she was her and Bill Clinton were fine to That was the first test that we know of depleted uranium weapons on the public up in the Balkans war there. So I was just trying to recap some of the lowest points of her legacy on that video. So that's pretty much been forgotten now. It never really took off as an issue. And there's the people in the areas where the Clinton regime dropped this. Ammunition, their cancer rates four times, their cancer death rate is four times higher than average. That's only one of a long string of tragedies. Of course, I touched a bit on the Clinton Foundation and the billions. The main point I made was the billions that she ripped off of Haiti. Let's look at this. The UN trusted her and Bill Clinton to raise all this money for Haiti, and it was well over $6 billion went missing. Yeah. Where did it go?
It was even more than that, I think.
This was an outrage of that. Haiti, as we all know, is one of the most impoverished nations on Earth.
A lot of kids went missing. A lot of children went missing, apparently, too, taken from their homes and their families, and nobody has seen hide nor hair of them since.
I mean, and I want to kind of tie this in here. Now, see, what you saw there was they were working closely with the UN. And I've been studying the machinations behind a lot of this going on in the Middle East. And when, of course, the EU migrant crisis hit, that was a really big wake-up call that something was very amiss. The way that got orchestrated and foisted on the public, mainly by Merkel. It was backed overwhelmingly by all the EU technocrats themselves were overwhelmingly in favour of that. Now, so I thought to myself, well, what is going on here? And it's such a headfuck of disinformation. I started looking up on the main EU dissenter, Mr. Nigel Farage, Nigel Farage, English patriot, into border protection stuff, he was continuously being harassed and accused of racism for wanting to protect the English borders, basically. And he's a very intelligent man, very passionate and very proud of his culture. Now, I was like, what's really going on here? So I looked back in time through some of his he was a member of the EU. I looked back in time, and when the Syrian invasion was all being discussed, he was basically the only person in the EU saying waging war in the Middle East is not the answer. He's very eloquent. He was very intelligent. He's saying, look at how bad Iraq is. He was saying, look at how bad after Gaddafi has gone from Libya. He's standing up in EU saying, we've turned these countries into anarchic hellholes. We are creating more problems than we know what to do with by following this agenda. He was being shouted down in the EU by all these elitist technocrats who then, with breathtaking hypocrisy, several years later, when Nigel Farage was fully coming out with let's leave the EU and stand up for border protection, the majority of people in the EU and the politicians in his home country were screaming that he was a racist. These people calling Nigel Farage a racist are the same people that are happy to drop bombs on civilians and cause hundreds of thousands of people to die, more probably. I would not know the exact figures, but it's hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. Millions of people have been displaced. And
you can support mass murder, just don't be racist.
Yeah. And don't stand up for having fairly strict border controls on your country. So I traced this all back, and this really, I mean, obviously there's some other agenda going on there for this whole bunch of stinking hypocrisy to be playing out in this way. So I had a look back. I saw a few people commenting on something called the Kalergi Plan. Now, I don't know how many listeners are familiar with Count Richard von Coudenhove Kalergi, but he actually wrote a book in the mid-1920s. It came out in 1925, actually. Everything that's going on now, he wrote a book about creating the European Union. In this book, it had his plans to slowly dismantle all the nation states within Europe and slowly dismantle all the nationalities and all the different geopolitical nations within Europe. And as that slowly happens, he would open up the borders of this new European Union that he envisaged. And this guy was not Jewish. He was an Austrian aristocrat, but he was married to a Jewish wife, and he had a lot of influence. And he was also, interestingly enough, a Freemason. His ultimate plan, in his utopian, crazy leftist idealistic vision that he had, was that finally, when the time was right, would be to flood the whole of the EU with massive amounts of immigrants from the African nations and from the Arabic nations, and basically force all the races to interbreed. And
cultures, religions, just everything, not just, you know, just the
whole mix. That's right. He was the originator of the modern cultural dialectic going on now.
You do realize, though, that it's like the 32nd or 33rd degree MO of the Freemasons. It is said to be ordo ab chao, which is it means order out of chaos. Like they from what I understand, that is pursued with the religious zeal. You know, it really at all costs they will see that is implemented wherever it is that they find themselves, whatever the situation. So yeah, total Order out of Chaos.
And
Ad Infinitum.
Interestingly enough, they keep doing this. Whoever these people are, we can guess, and there are certain individuals we know. But throughout the ages, there has set all the evidence points to this sort of cultural smashing from elites. Now, what you saw here with Richard Coudenhove Kalergi was he released this book. It was called Practical Idealism. It basically deified. It was at the height of eugenics. I used to work in an antique bookstore, mm-hmm. and it really surprised me the number of books from the 1920s and 1930s that were written by noblemen and leading scientists of the day, and they were openly into combining races to create the Superman or other race. There was one book I was reading, and it was like, oh, you know, Italians have the lowest IQ of all of Europe, so what we've got to do is just open up their borders to all the Negroid races, and we can breed the Italians with the Negroes and create these kind of slave, working class, mule-type race. And, in fact, that was a pivotal plank of Count Coudenhove Kalergi's plan. When he released the book, he was, within a very short time, he was actually approached by one of the Rothschilds of the day. It was Baron Louis de Rothschild, actually, and he got introduced to Max Warburg, the Jewish banker. Interestingly enough, they said, we really like your book, because within his book, he said that Kalergi came from a background that was very, very pro-Zionistic. His father was a very close friend with, who was that? Theodor Herzl, yes, thank you very much, Theodor Herzl. So he came back from this very pro-Zionist background. In his book, Practical Idealism, he stated that the Jews' genetic superiority, once again, it was that eugenics of the time thing, is that he thought that the Jews had some genetic lineage that made them superior to the rest of the European stock. And his breeding plan was eventually that they create this cultural Marxist social utopia, because all the different races were just interbred to the point where they became this light brown monoculture. Then they'd all become this working stock. They'd all have the same education, standardized religion, standardized opportunities in life. And then the Jews, along with certain bloodlines that were chosen for their elite qualities, either they had people that came from a background of very high IQs or great physical strength and fortitude, would be chosen out, and their bloodlines would continue onwards with all their history intact, their culture intact, and that these people would end up being part of what we would now know as the Greater Israel. So they'd become these ruling elites over the rest of the plebeians.
The Greater Israel Project, which ties into this whole business of PNAC and the neocons, PNAC, of course, being Project for New American Century, and all the the central players within that enterprise, Jeb Bush, who else was there? Dick Cheney, the Wolfowitz character, I think Condoleezza Rice. But a lot of people don't know, I think, if just to back things up a little bit, what world Zionism, political Zionism, and the attempt to bring about this independent state of Israel, largely what I guess they refer to as like a Jewish-type homeland, it emerged out of the mid-19th century or something like that. The roots didn't go back much further than that, and it really was an elitist movement. It had no populist support, and that's why for a lot of people looking at things, just, you know, the way that everything has evolved, that without this Holocaust, this mini Holocaust, because, I mean, you look at World War II, we're talking 10 to 12 times the amount, assuming you buy into the official magical 6 million mark, which a lot of people don't, of course, because it's totally, the whole thing is like ridiculous and just totally pumped over the top and exaggerated. But let's, for the sake of argument, let's accept that it's still far, 10 to 12 times as many people, the non-Jewish, you know, Gentile, Goy, however you want to.
8 million Russians.
Many, many, yeah. And they were Christians. They were Christians. So they needed that, I guess, really was what it seems, to bring about the state of Israel and then to promote this larger, you know, world Zionist agenda. But yeah, please carry on. We've only got, like, we're actually over time now as it is. I'm not sure if you want to wrap things up or how you want to wrap things up exactly. Okay. But the League of Nations, I know you've talked about in the past. But we've also got this one other subject that we're really hoping to get into. Might have to save that for the after show, this business of these Aussie hieroglyphics that were decoded by the head of this UFO cult that you were a member of, if I got my story straight, back in the day. And I mean, that's something that we haven't really got into, but it's some great after show material for sure. However you want to play it. So go ahead.
Well, I'm going to wrap up on the cultural smashing of Europe. Was Coudenhove Kalergi's book came out in 1925. He was bankrolled by the Warburgs and the Rothschilds become the first head of the Pan-Europa movement. They basically pulled him aside and said, look, you've got the vision, you're the man. I think it really helped that he wasn't actually a Jew as such. Because if a Jew had have come out saying those kind of things, it would have looked a little bit more like there's a bit of vested interest there, whereas to have a non-Jew proposing that the Jews were the master race.
A Shabbos Goy.
Yeah, well, a crypto-Jew or some, whatever they call them. So anyway, like the war got in the way of the first League of Nations. So he was basically head of what he was head of was the Pan-Europa movement. After the war, he was straight back onto it. President Truman read some stuff that he posted about reunifying all of Europe under something like the EU is now. And Truman absolutely took him on board and backed him. There was another reason for this. What it ended up becoming, the CIA, really, they always favoured the European Union, because it was a chance for the Americans to deal with all the European nations as a single state, whereas to get their trade, their military agendas, their this, their that, they have to negotiate singly with each European country on its own. The CIA saw it as a real bonus as part of carving the world into like six or seven blocks of empire headed by a corporatocracy, this supranational corporatocracy, basically. So he took back off with the European Parliament. Kalergi took back up with that with the backing of Truman and many other people as the European Parliamentary Union straight after World War II. And he was head at the European Parliamentary Union, which morphed into the EU, right up until 1970. Every year, or every couple of years, depending on how they feel, to this day, the European Union gives out a Kalergi Award for bringing Europeans closer together under humanitarian ideals. They also call it the Charlemagne Prize, but I've seen Angela Merkel has recently won the Kalergi Award. That's to the public, they call it the Charlemagne Prize, but I've seen her with her certificate. And when somebody did a real close-up of the camera, and you could see that Count Coudenhove Kalergi's name was written very big on that. So all these people, Tony Blair's won it, Otto von Habsburg, who was the leader of the EU for years, Angela Merkel, all these people have done these diabolical things and basically helped to destroy European democracy on behalf of the EU, have been winning the Kalergi Prize. And if there's any doubt about the over-involvement of Jewish interests in the EU, is you only have to look at the EU flag. There's that was designed by Mr. Kalergi, and there's 12 stars on the EU flag representing the 12 nations of Israel.
Oh, is that what they stand for?
Oh, yes, they do.
No doubt about it, huh? So 12 tribes or what have you. So
yeah, the 12 tribes of Israel represented right there in the European Parliament. Like, why should the flag be represented? Basically, the EU flag is representing Israel, if we think about it in that way. And if we think about this cultural smashing, what it's come down to now is a lot of the younger people don't have very much of an idea of the history of their own race or that. I'm getting a lot of flack for young people for actually being proud of the good points of white European culture, which is these good points are with we're actually the first people as an empire to officially decide that slavery was a bad thing and to legally outlaw it. Okay, I know that there were still problems for a few generations to come, but we literally sat down, and the humanitarian side of the white race has always been very, very strong. So what we're seeing now with this cultural Marxism is that there's a lot of younger white people that, from the left side especially, they have this, the number of times I hear them saying, like, white people are to blame for everything in the world. And all I have to say to them these days is, I said, well, look, I said, we stand for freedom of speech. We stand for, in principle, we stand for representative democracy. I know we don't get as much of that as we should, but that is the principle underpinning our culture. I say we stand for equality of opportunity for everyone. I say, and these younger people will keep criticizing, oh, no, white people have done all these bad things and it's this slavery and this. I say, well, tell you what. go to a standard Islamic country, my friend, just not even an extreme one. Go to Indonesia. And all these things you're critiquing your own culture on here, you have freedom of speech. You're allowed to do that. I said, go to Indonesia, start criticizing the genocidal policies of their government that they're utilizing against the West Papuans. Start criticizing their religion that they follow, Islam. I said, you are going to find yourself either stoned to death by a mob or you will be shoved in jail for 10 years, no doubt about it. This just absolutely either stuns these young people or they get really, really angry at me because it's a fact. So I've been to Indonesia. You are not, even as a guest there, as a visitor, as a tourist, if you criticise Islam, they don't care. They will stick you in jail for 2 to 5 years. And I'll tell you what. A Indonesian Islamic-run jail where you've bad-mouthed Islam, if you go in there, man, you are not going to come out the same. If you come out, you will not be the same person.
I wouldn't imagine, no. Maybe, in fact, going back to what you're speaking of earlier regarding this whole business of, sodomy and buggering and various contexts and cultures. And that's why a lot of people don't understand this, but really the top number one major victims of rape actually are men, not women. And a lot of it gets lost on a lot of people. They don't understand that until you draw it to their attention. It's because it's happening behind closed doors, out of sight, out of mind, in places like prisons, you know, primarily. So or in as you just, you know, alluded to earlier, in the context of the military, navy, those sort of things, and that it's just not talked about. It's just there's just too much shame involved, I guess, or intimidation, threats, coercion, and the like.
I mean, what we've had is under cultural Marxism, you had the 60s and 70s feminists have their uprising. Now there were some very good points to that kind of feminism, but you know, there were some genuine issues these people needed to fight. But what seemed to happen was, overall, the worst of these feminists who basically hated white culture and hated men, Susan Sontag,
Gloria Steinem.
All these crazy chicks. Well-known,
long-time CIA asset, apparently.
And they all ended up getting premier positions in universities, in education systems, and in the media. You know, like, for instance, Susan Sontag, here's one of her direct quotes. "The truth is that Mozart, Pascal, Boolean algebra, Shakespeare, parliamentary government, Baroque churches, Newton, the emancipation of women, Kant, Marx, and Balanchine ballets don't redeem what this particular civilization has wrought upon the world. The white race is the cancer of human history." I mean, these people get into these positions of privilege, and time again, they're allowed to absolutely badmouth our culture. Now, we have free speech, fine, but okay, if I get into a position of privilege and start pointing out bad things going on that the Islamic Moors did to the Europeans, or the Ottoman Empire and the amount of people that got killed by the Islamics. These days, as you're well aware, and a lot of people are aware, if we point out the same failings with the Islamic Empire, we instantly get screamed at that we're being racist, that we've got this it's this bizarre situation where we're expected to absolutely badmouth and criticize our own race, but you know, other races that have had very similar histories of conquest and oppression, we're not even allowed to mention that they did exactly the same
thing. Oh, geez, and that's the thing, is like the kind of what you're talking about here about, you know, white people and whatnot. A lot of people talk about this. You hear it time and time again. I want clarity. I want clarification. No, the white race. Okay, so Asians are yellow. We might have gone over this yesterday. We did just a brief pre-interview, of course, but Asians are yellow. If you want to label people, that's how it's usually done. Well, those are the yellow people, and the Indians over in North America, they're the red ones, and Africa's the black people. Europeans are whites. Where does that leave these ethnic Jews? What color are they? Is it kind of like a shade of something, or, you know, is it purple, or what color are we going to pin on them? The fact of the matter is that, to me, it seems there's a heavy, it's complicated, actually, and I'm not into this whole white black thing, you know, that whole business to begin with, really. But you're talking about the slave trade and white people in the slave trade. Well, this Spielberg put that famous movie back together a number of years ago, and the Roots series that was done by was Alex Haley. And the way there's no discussion either of those, I don't believe, other than demonizing the wicked white man heading, going to Africa and, you know, snatching up all these poor, African people to throw them into lives of slavery, and many of them dying, of course, on the trip over to the West. But what they leave out is the role of the Jewish slave masters. There were quite a few. They played apparently a very central role and were very dominant in that industry for quite a few years. In fact, we were talking to Seth Haven just not so long ago. I think James might have even been there as well, and he seemed to think that the majority of pirates were Jewish. But I think that's a bit of an overstatement myself.
Well,
you know, but make of that what is
yours. Well, it's keep
that in mind.
Sorry, Matt.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's just important for people to bear in mind and not be fooled or deceived, or for have these people bully or try to, you know, intimidate them. They shut down their intellectual, their thinking faculties.
Well, what I appreciate about my white culture is the Enlightenment values that we had, which was all those values I said, which is every person is equal. All ideas are worthy of equal consideration, you know, and the idea is that when we objectively examine all these ideas, that the ultimately the best idea will win. But taking it back to the pirate thing, now when sure, England was an empire, it did some bad things, but when the English had a very strong current of emancipationists who really drove for the abolition of slavery. And when it finally went through as law, Europeans were no longer able to keep slaves. Guess who were the main people fighting against the remaining rebellious slave traders? Was the English were sending out their navy because there were some people who weren't obeying that law. Most of those people not obeying those laws actually were North African Islamics.
Right.
So the North African Islamics were raiding the weaker tribes from different parts of the African coast.
Well, not only that, Stompy, there's a history I just discovered recently. It's amazing what happens when you start looking into these things. They made their way all through like places in Scandinavia, Iceland, all kinds of different places in the West, these Islamic pirate raiders, these slave traders and so forth.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously they felt that they weren't bound to any laws that Europe made, so they kept doing their thing. Britain took it upon themselves to send out their warships. That was the good side of the English colonial idea, was that if these people are hanging around our colonies, breaking our laws, we do actually have to prosecute them. Sure, they're taking away black people, but under the enlightened side of the empire, that was like, well, they are citizens of our empire and they deserve our protection. So that's very interesting that it was also white people from the 1860s onwards who were the main people actually fighting, like when I say fighting slavery, they were getting into pitched battles on the high seas with these Islamic traders. And this is something that's, all these aspects are things that are being completely overlooked. You're also overlooking, you know, sure, Christians have done some very bad things in history, but you're overlooking that there were certain Christian people who went to these countries and they built medical facilities, they built schools, they helped build housing, they tried to bring a certain level of stability and peace to these areas. Now, if the white colonialist history is so bad, why would people actually risk their safety and their lives and go to these far-flung corners of the world if they didn't have a certain core belief of altruism and a certain core belief of equality, of decency of all people around the world? That's the other side that in this cultural Marxist milieu is just, they've thrown the baby out with the bathwater. They're just it's absolutely crazy. And I've actually lost a number of friends for speaking out like this. I will agree with the negative points that people are making about the if they're true negative points, I will say, yes, we have historically done that. When I counteract with these the positive side of the Western legacy to the world, and I talk about my granddad getting off his butt and volunteering to fight Nazism on behalf of everybody in the world, a lot of these people can't handle it. They can get the. I nearly got my head punched in at the pub the other day by a guy about 28, 29 years old who just would not stop bad-mouthing the West and everything about the West. And the more I was saying all these points, he was getting angrier and angrier, and it got to the point where he got thrown out of the pub by the bartender. So this cultural Marxism, the cognitive dissonance that's being indoctrinated into so many young people's heads now, they actually think you're a racist for standing up for the positive things in your own history, that your forefathers have fought. Our forefathers fought for this.
That's millions. Well, that's what they were told, wasn't it, with the fight against Nazism and even being sent to places like Vietnam, for example. You got to wonder how those vets who, a lot of them still alive today, although their numbers are dwindling, I suppose, as each day passes. But ostensibly, they were told that it was to stop the spread of communism throughout Southeast Asia and presumably the rest of the world. Now, what is it that we've had here ever since the Clinton administration is China's most favored trading nation status is how it was written into, I guess, law, for lack of a better word, upon with the stroke of Clinton's pen, that that would be in perpetuity, you know, forever into infinity. So, yeah, you got to wonder how some of those vets feel about that, the con job and the false bill of goods that was sold to them. But just one quick thing, finally, that I'd like to point out to with respect to what you're getting at here with the positive things people can take a look at and that have emerged over the years is the resurgence of Buddhism in India. That was all done. It was lost in the jungles of northern India for well over 1,000 years, and it would, who knows, it could still be buried somewhere in the middle of nowhere, all the dense underbrush and so forth, if it hadn't been for these British architects, engineers, surveyors and whatnot, that somewhere around like the early to mid 19th century, they came across these ancient ruins and archaeological discoveries and just began documenting and archiving everything that they managed to come across. And from there, Buddhism was rediscovered by the West. Quite a fascinating story. So that, which really flies in the face of, I guess it's the Edward Said and his famous book Orientalism. I guess he takes a very negative approach to basically condemning and attacking whitey, as if all the bad things that are done in the name of empire. I mean, it's the monarchy that's ultimately behind it as well, too, of course. So, you know, it's with the whole chain of command and pecking order and so forth. It is a little more complicated, I think, than what some people might want to kind of, you know, lay it all out there. But
yes, well, Catholicism's always been a number one culprit too. Now, now we're seeing with the latest pope is the latest pope. This is so interesting. He's the whole fake news.
Yeah.
Thing with,
oh, geez, yeah. Fake news. What, the Vatican's fecal matter, the big obsession with
what's really interesting is this latest pope is actually, speaking of that, the whole Kalergi, long-range effects of the Kalergi plan and everything. Really? First of all, his first thing that he did was he did a tour of the Middle East, really sucking up to all the major players of Islam. He was at, there was some Islamic mosque that no Christian has ever set foot in before, and he got to go in there. Then after he'd done this tour of the Middle East, he literally released a statement to the public saying Christians and Islamics should be like brothers, because Christianity and Islam are basically the same religion. And as somebody with some fairly strong Christian roots, I'm a skeptical, open-minded Christian, but I've got a lot of criticism for certain types of Christianity. But when I saw him say it, I was like, well, it's not the source material, isn't, you know, the Bible and the Quran. Well, let's have a look at, I mean, the Old Testament of the Bible, of course, is very bloodthirsty, but a Christian is someone who follows the teachings of Christ. Himself, everything he said was, like, pretty much on the nail and fantastic. He supported people being forgiving, for coming together, for forgiving each other's sins, for trying to be a community. He was trying to get people to be less dogmatic, more accepting of women's equality. You know, he's trying to stop women getting stoned to death. There's that famous story where some chick was going to get stoned to death, and he said, well, the person without any sin here cast the first rock. Mm-hmm. And if you compare that to the stories in the Quran, which have got tend to have a lot of kill the unbeliever and a woman is worth half of what a man is. For the Pope to make a claim like that about Christians, that's just absolute horseshit. So to see him making all these statements that are ostensibly supporting the cultural Marxist, the annihilation of the European culture's legacy as, you know, who we are, what we have been, is being tipped down the drain in favor of this negative, stereotypical hatred. It's when people give this absolute mono-dimensional horseshit about the white race of, you know, what they're saying is there's no difference between the Irish culture, there's no difference between Spanish, there's no difference between Scandinavian. Everyone is just lumped into this, oh, you're white, you're evil, you're bad, you're all colonizers.
It's pretty ignorant, you know, that's being generous about it too.
If we boil this down to the most, I did quite a funny YouTube, but if we boil this down to the most basic, that's the same way as me looking at all the different Indigenous Australian cultures that had existed before whites were here.
Yeah.
And say, well, you were all just a bunch of black guys sitting around in the desert with boomerangs and spears, telling mythical stories. And, well, basically, you were just one culture, and you didn't have enough Eskimo genetics in you. You know, you should have opened up your borders and let more Eskimos in here. When we say it in this kind of way, suddenly you're aware of the ludicrous nature of making these kind of statements and these claims, you know?
Identity politics. You brought it up a time or two here over the course of our discussion, and really I think that's just – I'm reminded of that once again and how powerful a role it plays in impacting people's minds and the decisions that they make and the ways that they approach and work on relating with others. Who might not necessarily be of the same background that they are, whether it's ethnic, cultural, or what have you. But so it's really, and divide and conquer, that whole business. So we've covered a lot of ground here today, Stompy. And one of the things, you said thank you?
Oh, I just said thank you.
Yeah. You're more than welcome. We're really happy to have people such as yourself come by and join us on board. And the reason we do invite folks such as yourself is because we find you intriguing, and we love to hear all the stories that people are able to share with us and our listeners. And hopefully we can all learn from this and get kind of the, you know, the creative and intellectual juices flowing and work as a team and a crew and a group and a community of aspiring pirates to grow together and have some good things come of it all. So you did mention the Aussie Indigenous people. I think we're gonna head back to the Rogues Gallery here. I'm not sure if we're going to the Mossy Wench or the Howling Wolf or you know, the Scurvy Dog.
I'd just like to say on a final note is myself being proud about my culture. This equally applies to all the different cultures in the world. So, obviously Africans have got very, you know, different types of Africans have different kinds of great things about their culture.
Right.
You know, sure. Polynesian islanders have various different things. So,
of course.
If we boil, I'm just doing a final boil down of this cultural Marxism. What it is obviously leading to is a cultural monoculture where everything just becomes standardized. Mm-hmm. People aren't allowed to say anything that's too out of place that will upset or offend other people. Yeah. So what you're seeing is a standardization of the genetic material on this planet, a standardization of the thinking patterns on the planet.
Universal hive mind.
That's what really scares me. And when I've hung around some of these young people, of course, they don't have much life experience. It's not their fault. But, you know, people from the age of 16 to 23, they're all sitting around smoking spliffs and being like, oh, you know, like, fuck the patriarchy, fuck white culture and all this and that. And they somehow think, you know, just, you know, smoking a few spliffs and being negative about their culture as being this sort of cultural warrior. And I can actually see where it's leading. It's a kind of very dopey, nihilistic way to go in the end, and it leaves you very, very open for the dialogues of other people to actually drive your culture in any sort of direction. Like, we're all seeing it for what it is now. And this is actually being it was an idea from the 1930s of critical theory, where instead of taking over cultures through warfare, this was brought up with the Frankfurt School, was if you control the media and you control what people think and talk about, you can eventually steer them.
That's right.
You can herd.
Yeah.
You can make them into a herd hive mind and steer them in the direction that you want.
That's what Marx talked about when he referred to the means of mental reproduction, I would imagine. And that's so much of what politics and government governing, speaking of steering, that has to exactly, you're precisely right, of course, naturally, yes.
Whereas I see the future, this is me myself, I see the future as people being more true to their patriotic identity, because when you have cultures that have built up for thousands of years and they've flourished, those people have got various attributes about their culture, because the conditions those people live under in that environment have created a unique culture. If you look at Indigenous Indians or Indigenous Polynesians, Indigenous Africans, they've generally got a basic tribal wisdom of what works in their culture, and that then breeds a particular cultural type. So obviously you want to strengthen what is positive and what works best for those individual cultures, and that of course actually breeds true multiculturalism, whereas this top-down Kalergi plan idea of multiculturalism of just erase all borders and smash everyone together. That's the opposite. It leads us into a monocultural desert being ruled by elites.
Mm-hmm. Mishmash and smorgasbord kind of mishmash and mixing. But and what's a bit Zbigniew Brzezinski, and I'm surprised this hadn't come up until now, right at the end here, but this class, what he wrote about in his book, aptly titled The Clash of Civilizations, from there, of course, dialectically arising this whole business, once again, as was mentioned earlier, the order out of chaos, and the secret, of course, the trick being to steer to the end, the desired end result, via the Hegelian dialectical process. So it is pretty straightforward in a lot of ways, I think, Stompy, but I'm not sure if you agree to that or not, but also more subtle and complicated on other levels. So, but, you know, thanks once again for being a part of the formal end of things. We really shot over the mark here today. Once again, you lived up to your title of raconteur, as we'd hoped you would, so that's great. Maybe we can have you back in some fashion at some point before too long, even maybe switching off with in the event that Pirate Larry is not able to make it back or is busy at some other future date. James can't hold down things aloft the crow's nest. Maybe get you seated up there and we can sail along here.
Yeah, sure.
On the Robin Hood. We're just kind
of... I've got a little bit too much general knowledge of a lot of things. I've had an interesting life. I can tend to waffle on too much.
Let's save it for the after show, because we got a lot to talk about there, including this business of these hieroglyphics that were, I guess, you've supposedly decoded by your one-time cult leader.
That's John McGovern.
Yeah, and this is the business. I got the Keys of Enoch, Council of Nine. Something to do with Los Alamos. I'm not sure if that's what that is. Yes. Some kind of military installment of some kind. And let's not forget one more time to hear it from Minds.com. How are you enjoying the ride on Minds.com to this point?
Thank you so much for having me. And one more time for anyone listening, if you want to download my music, there's some free stuff too. Go to kicktone.com. It's all one word. You'll find a music site there. Just type my name in and... there's some stuff for sale and there's some stuff to download for free. It's pretty cool. You're going to swing us out with a Stray Dog polka there, Jaffe?
That is the plan. Although we've actually got, there's someone here who was actually standing by. I'm not sure if you Well, we had mentioned him earlier, so it looks like he's in the wings. We just got someone just we have an update. Hang on just a second. Is he got the captain? Yeah. Make sure Stompy's. He wants. Yeah, Stompy's online. Okay. Get you. One second. We got the captain coming.
Ah, Stompy, it's a real pleasure to have you drop back to us, listen down the wings. And many of the stories and information that you shared there really rang true. It's a pleasure to have you on board. And we think that your pirate credentials are well up to speed. Good enough for the Robin Hood, most definitely. We're putting together this motley crew. It's a really ragged bunch of voyagers and adventurers. So, once again, just thank you for taking the time to be a part of things. Your family history is quite fascinating, and you really seem to be some of those cut out to sail upon the high digital seas.
No worries, Captain. It's a pleasure anytime. And go easy on the cabin boys, sir.
Hey, let's not go there now. That'd not be part of the Robin Hood. In fact, the ship's car, the ship's articles, any buggering of the cabin boys or the powder monkeys. I mean, you walk the plank real quick or something like that. That's a simple to tolerate. Wait till you get to shore. We were happy to hook any of our crew members up with the ladies of the port. Many of our people can be found. Not a problem.
Any buggery of the captain boy, and you'll be thrown to the bikers.
Most definitely. Well, we have our ways of dealing with it. Anytime a situation like this arises, believe me, it's not, the end result is not, it's not pretty. So, until next time, happy sailing.
Happy sailing, sir. It's a pleasure to be on board, sir.
I think he has gone back. Yeah, I think he's at the pub there once again. Not sure which one exactly, but, there we go. So, got the old thumbs up there from Captain Long John Sinclair. And as you mentioned, Stompy, in the meantime, we are going to take things out here with your Stray Dog Polka. What independent release was this off of? And secondly, we never did talk about, I don't think, the tune that has been selected for the movie soundtrack, but make you quickly throw that out there as well.
Oh, that's a little tune called Black Life. Originally, it was going to be some underground film about a parrot that hated its life. But apparently, the directors had some falling out and left the movie. So the director wrote much of the script, so now they're cutting it back to some strange indie release that's mainly showcasing Australian music. And but I've done a few bits and pieces for movie soundtracks. I'm on harmonica. I'm what's known as a session musician.
Right.
So they,
sure.
They booked me in to play. I've been on commercials, and some of my harmonicas ended up on a US movie soundtrack. Various bands have got me in as a session harmonica player throughout the years. So my harmonica playing is out there. So. On that final note, dear sir, I will.
A parrot that hates its life on a pirate ship. Now there's a twist. That would be something.
Oh yeah,
get me off the pirate ship! Run off the pirate ship! Unchain me!
Something. Who knows? Yeah.
Not the harmonica. No, not the harmonica.
So. Once again, so Stray Dog Polka, and it can be found via the links that you've mentioned, of course. And yep. Thanks once again. We are going to hook up with you hopefully here in the after show, the Rogues Gallery. Until then, folks, next week we've got David Allen Zimbeck planning on joining us. We have him booked for same time next week, 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 11 out east, 1 o'clock Saturday in Tokyo and Seoul. For the Robin Hood and All Its Crew, episode 46 with Lord Stompy is now officially a wrap. We'll catch you folks on the flip-flop.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Unleash the nighttime sky. Let this whole earth cry with longing.
dog pack howl wails. Make a sardine for not belonging. I too am a stray dog here. Do not fear. We'll keep each other warm and safe from harm. Dark clouds come and we begin. Twine in fear and make a din. Storm's coming. Hide in holes beneath the floor. Terrifying thunder roll is drumming. Chattering teeth pushing up my tail. Is no avail. The pack is scattered before the coming storm. Trail, territory, piss and sniffing tail, eyes rolling. Barking cat and stalking mad, underdogs on their backside rolling. Makes me glad I am on my own. I'm free to roam. Be kind to stray dog, he'll scratch fleas off you. Yes, I am a stray dog too. I need some patting and consoling. Kind words never go astray. Scratch my back, let me do some rolling. I will jump around and lick your nose, nibble your toes. Be kind to stray dog, he'll be you. And all the while we're howling symphonies up to the trees. Must keep each other warm and safe from harm. And all the while we're howling symphonies up to the trees. We'll keep each other. Unleash the nighttime sky and let this whole earth cry with longing. Let dog pack howl wail, make a sorry din for not belonging.